From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later, Big Brother wants to identify your voice and iris. Then later on, a remarkable journey by a remarkable man. But first, here's what's happening. Well, here we go again, and let's hope it's not as bad as the BP oil spill. But off the Louisiana coast, oil has impacted 30 miles of shoreline so far. The Coast Guard is continuing cleanup and recovery operations in the Grand Isle region after fresh crude oil began washing ashore. No idea yet just where the source of this spill. Oil was reported to be washing ashore over the weekend, prompting the Coast Guard, along with other state and local agencies, to begin cleanup and recovery operations of impacted shorelines. Captain Kelly Sweeney on the line with us here. Kelly, do we know where this is coming from at all?
Well, first, ahoy, George, to you and all the Coast listeners. And you know, every year there are around 2,000 or more reported oil spills in our waters of the Gulf, George. Now, as you said, the Coast Guard has tested this oil that has washed up and verified it to be fresh Louisiana crude, not leftover oil from the BP spill or oil from somewhere else that was spilled from an oil tanker.
Could it be a leak from some drill?
Yeah, my sources there say there are two possibilities, or it's likely from. The first one would be from dredging operations, which kicked up some oil that was on the bottom, but that wouldn't necessarily be fresh oil. It's also likely, and I think it's probably more likely, that there is a well off the Louisiana coast, which was damaged during Hurricane Katrina, that was being plugged and capped on Saturday and leaked crude for about 6 hours. While this capping operation was going on, and the prevailing currents from the Mississippi would have pushed that oil towards the beaches at the Elmer Island Wildlife Refuge, where it's been coming up.
At this point, it does not seem to be as bad as the BP spill, right?
No, nowhere near. No, not at all.
Okay, we'll monitor this. Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Sweeney. The Food and Drug Administration will halt imports of dairy products and produce from the area of Japan where a nuclear reactor is leaking radiation. The FDA said those foods will be detained at entry, will not be sold to you. The agency previously said that it would just step up screening of those foods. Other foods imported from Japan, including seafood, still will be sold to you, but screened first for radiation. An unfounded scientific assertion by a non-scientist has swept across the web like a tsunami over the past few days. In an article in Newsweek, writer Simon Winchester claimed that the 9.0 magnitude Japan earthquake, following close on the heels of the recent quakes in New Zealand and Chile, has ratcheted up the chances of a catastrophic seismic event striking in California. In his article, "The Scariest Earthquake Is Yet to Come," Winchester pointed out that all three of those recent earthquakes occurred along faults on the edge of the Pacific Plate, the giant tectonic puzzle under the Pacific Ocean. And they also say this butts up against the North American Plate along the San Andreas Fault. Jim Berkland, our own geologist, says we can expect one, just doesn't know exactly when. Europe's top court advisor dealt a huge blow to the anti-GM food lobby, saying that states broke EU laws by halting genetically modified crop cultivation without first seeking action in Brussels. The European court provided a major fillip to a lawsuit for Hungary genetically modified food industry and stunned enraged environmental campaigners who thought that they were going to win. A U.S. warplane on patrol in Libya crash-landed in Libya after a mechanical failure. The U.S. military says the crew of the F-15E Eagle are safe. And tonight, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the battles continue, but she's hearing stories that Muammar Gaddafi might want to seek exile somewhere. Ryan Morrow, founder of WorldThreats.com, national security advisor to the Christian Action Network, an intelligence analyst with the Asymmetric Warfare and Intelligence Center. He's on with us here. Ryan, what are you picking up? What sources are you hearing from the Libyan front?
Well, it looks like the U.S. objective right now is to cause the cessation of hostilities. It is not regime change. It is to set up an autonomous region in the eastern part of Libya that's kind of self-governing and democratic.
So, but at this point, Gaddafi still is in power, and he continues to fight. How much more can he take before he's got to get out of there?
he can take a lot, because you have to remember the rebels encircled him in Tripoli and were marching on him, and he was able to fight back. And so now the rebels have been pushed back to the east. So I think that it looks like he's going to stay in power in an extremely deranged state. And this looks like it'll be a long-term military commitment then, because we're going to have to keep operating that no-fly zone, which results in a long-term military commitment as opposed to just taking them out.
Ryan, there's some concern that the group is not that organized in trying to deal with Gaddafi. What do you hear?
I'm actually impressed by their organization, considering how quickly they had to put it together. They have a leadership structure. They had offices operating in Benghazi. And so I'm impressed with it. It's not a full-fledged government in exile, but that would be unrealistic expectations.
And what does your gut tell you? We're going to get him out or not?
No, I don't. I think that is not the objective right now. The rebels are not strong enough to do it on their own, and we are unwilling to provide them air cover if they want to take an offensive into Gaddafi's territory.
Okay, so that's Ryan Morrow's thoughts on what's going on in Libya. New home. The dream of many would-be buyers makes less and less financial sense in many places. A wave of foreclosures has driven down the cost of previously occupied homes and made them even more of a bargain. By contrast, new homes have become more expensive. The median price of a new home in the United States is now 48% higher than that of a home being resold. 48% higher. More than three times the gap in a healthy housing market. And the United States is on a fiscal path toward insolvency, and policymakers are at a tipping point, according to a Federal Reserve official. He says if we continue down this path, we're going to become insolvent. Andre Eglishon on with us now, noted entrepreneur and host in his own right. We are heading toward insolvency, aren't we, Andre?
That is correct, George, and thank you so much for having me, and thank all the listeners of Coast to Coast for their support to your noble effort to get this kind of information out to the American people.
Well, you know, if this continues, if we keep going down this path, as the Federal Reserve executive said, that we could become insolvent, things could fall apart. How much time do we have, Andre?
Well, according to Tim Geithner, who sent a letter to Congress, and I'm reading this letter right now, Tim Geithner sent this letter on January 6th of this year, and he indicated very clearly to Harry Reid at that time that unless we raise the debt ceiling, we will become insolvent as a country, or we will default on our debt by the end of the first quarter of 2011. We have some $335 billion of headroom beneath the current debt limit. If this were to happen, George, this country would deteriorate beyond all imagination and very, very quickly.
Something we don't need. Andre, thank you so much. Now, you've heard about the quest to build a flying car. What about a flying motorcycle? And remember the scooter from Back to the Future? Well, up next, we're going to talk about that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. If you're into technology, you're going to love this hour. If you're into just mysteries of technology, you're going to love this hour. And if you like things like Back to the Future and flying, well, just wait a sec here. Let me tell you about somebody that I met a few weeks ago. I gave a speech before an organization called Metal in Los Angeles. I had a great time. It was an early morning Saturday event, and I met a lot of great people. And one of them, Desir Molnar, co-founder of Molnari. Now, this happens to be a vehicle design company that specializes in street legal aircraft. We're going to talk about that in a second. Des is also a pilot, flew jets in the U.S. Air Force, has a professional aeronautics degree from Embry-Riddle University, and performs in his own band, Casino Mansion. And here he is on Coast to Coast, Desir. Hey, how are you?
Good, George. Thanks for having me here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I've got to tell you, when I met you a couple weekends ago, and you showed me pictures of this flying motorcycle.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. It was an unbelievable design. Tell me about this and how that started.
Well, first of all, the reason it's a motorcycle is you basically have to choose your battles when you're developing new machinery. And One of the things I wanted to make sure in this machine was that it was completely legal in the air and on the ground. Because when I first started discussing this with some people, they said, well, you can't do it. It's just not allowed. It was funny that I was effectively assaulted by people trying to keep the status quo of what you can't do. So, again, in researching it, I just said, you know what? It's a lot easier to make motorcycles in this world than it is to make cars because there's a lot of fewer rules regulating.
Right.
So that was the approach I took. And also, people that ride motorcycles are genuinely optimistic people. They don't mind getting in the rain. They believe they're going to get there safely. Everyone says you're crazy, but they know they're good. So I started down that path with it, and I effectively built the first one. It was actually my first motorcycle. I built the first one at a factory up in outside of Santa Cruz, a place called Calfee Designs, a bicycle factory. Myself and Craig, we pretty much put our heads down and made this first one, and we flew it back in 2006. And the photos I showed you were effectively, you know, stuff that we've kept under wraps until recently. And,
sure.
And I really appreciate you having me here and just kind of rolling the project
out. And we've got a link for you on your Facebook.
Okay.
And people can see a sketch at coasttocoastam.com. You know, years ago, there was a television show, a cartoon, I loved it when I was a boy, called The Jetsons.
Of course.
And when I said to myself at that little age, as I said, you know what, I'm going to grow up, I'm going to have my flying car, and this is going to be great.
You and everybody.
You know, here I am now, getting to the age I am, still no flying car for me. Right. What happened to that promise?
Well, some people, I think, first off, with the Jetsons, it gave people a preconceived notion about the minimum that they would expect. So effectively, we had to wait around for someone to develop flubber.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that the only way that was valuable to fly was if you took off vertically, if you could put your machine in your suitcase, et cetera, et cetera. So again, you have to kind of back off. And one of the reasons I kept this project quiet up till now is I really wanted to kind of redefine what people's expectations would be. Otherwise, if you didn't have that, they would just genuinely be, you know, disappointed. So, the problem with the Jetsons, of course, is that, first of all, it's a cartoon, and it has the validity of bears that walk upright and play tricks on park rangers.
Yeah.
So what I needed to do with this was make sure that I had something, again, that would work. And I would say that, you know, there have been registered about 1,800 attempts at making flying cars. And the value of them is that when you're flying, if you need to land and drive the rest of the way through bad weather, et cetera, you can do it. It's a safety thing. Also, if you have the machine with you, situations turn bad, you can find another way home. So it's not a bad version of two things. It's actually a very, very good way of getting around. And that's why people have been struggling to make them for years. And I've kind of lost track of your question, but I guess the bottom line is with the Jetsons, don't hold your breath for flubber or to float around. But what I did was something that works today. And as long as people are at the leading edge of technology, you're always at the front. If you're just waiting for something to be developed, then you're just not in the game.
You know what traffic is like in Los Angeles.
Sure.
If you're on this motorcycle,
mm-hmm,
and you're stuck in traffic, are you allowed to just go right up and then pass everybody
again
in the air?
We're back to the rules. The first thing is, if imagine you're in traffic. And the other thing is, I didn't make this for LA. I made it for big cities. I made it for Sao Paulo, Brazil, Beijing. Have you been to these places?
I have not.
Mexico City, it takes you 12 hours to get around Sao Paulo across town in the middle of the day. And there are freeways of helicopters. So it's even tougher there. With this machine, one of the reasons the motorcycle is, imagine you're in New York, and you want to get across town. You're going to get there by Learjet, train, whatever. Fastest way across town is with a motorcycle. If you're on a Vespa scooter, nothing's going to beat it. You know, people drive around in Lincoln Town cars, forget it. Vespa's the way. So if you're in traffic and it's a motorcycle, you can split lanes. The Harley-Davidson guys have been very, very good about lobbying to keep it able to split lanes between cars because, you know, they have air-cooled engines. They got to keep moving.
Sure.
So rather than sitting, you know, people have locked themselves into automobiles that look more and more like living rooms than they are ways to get around. People are going slower now than they did 20 years ago. Freeway speeds drop every year. So in this situation,
and traffic increases,
of course. So now if it is a bike and you're in LA, you can get in the carpool lane. You can go between people. And one of the main reasons I made this was, you know, if things go wrong and you talk about LA traffic, imagine if you wanted to get out of here. It's not something you can just do. And as far as flying out, there's 20,000 airports in the United States. So you pull over, you drive to an airport, you sneak your way around cars, you get to an airport, you take off, and you fly.
Okay, so you have to take off from an airport.
You can't
do it from the street.
That's correct. And you can't drive 56 in a 55 zone. So again, if things get really wrong, you would like to have some options. But the reality is, I designed this one. It's a gyroplane.
And what does that mean?
What it means is that it's effectively like a sycamore leaf. It falls off a tree, it just spins. Exactly.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It's something that can fly with the engine off. It can fly quietly. But the other thing is that I didn't design this. The reason I jumped in the pool, I'll just say, is that, again, it's a matter of choosing your battles. If people fly into a city in a helicopter and they land on a roof, for instance, that helicopter is going to sit there until the guy leaves.
He's ready to leave again.
And he's used up the space, right?
Yeah.
What I wanted to do is I wanted to make something you could fly into a congested area and land and then drive out.
Yeah.
Not take off vertically as you described. Because, I mean, every time you've flown in an aircraft, you didn't take off vertically.
Do the props fold?
Yeah, they fold up.
They
so the rotor blades fold up. And what that means is that when you land, you really land. It's not like the wind's going to gust and blow you over. But it gives you the ability to fly in at a very, very low landing speed. I'm more interested in landing slow than taking off vertically. And this one will land about 12 miles an hour, basically.
How,
so if you got a headwind, it's straight down.
How high up can you go?
Well, this thing will get to about 10,000 feet.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, in the next term, yeah. So that'll get you over pretty much any mountain range in the States.
All right. The question I hate to ask,
they've
but I have
20.
To. Yeah. Something happens to the engine. You know, these things happen. Do you have a parachute? How are you going to?
Well, then you're the sycamore leaf. Then you just land. And you can land very slowly just about anywhere within the size of the rotor blades, effectively.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the main reason I picked it. Yeah.
Do you go straight down while you're...
You go, the glide ratio is about 4-1. So you can basically pick a distance.
Pick a spot.
So if you're a mile up, you can fly, 4 miles in any direction.
Okay. And just pick
crosswinds don't matter with rotor blades. And the other thing is gyroplanes are designed, the reason they were designed back in the 30s was so they would be a wing that wouldn't stall. So you wouldn't have the problem of flying too slow and falling out of the air. It's something that could just effectively land safe.
What kind of training would someone need to be able to fly one?
You'll need to be a pilot. I'm not trying to find a way around that. You need a license to fish. You need a license to cut hair. You need a license to fly. And you owe it to people on the ground. You don't want to fall on their heads. So a person will need a private rating or a sport plane rating to fly a gyroplane.
All right.
And that's 20 hours minimum, but hopefully they'll spend more time learning.
When you start producing them, how much are they going to cost people?
Well, right now, I'm not so focused on producing them as I am developing them. But, I mean, at the end game, they'll be, as low as $100,000, I would imagine, or less. And the reason I come up with that number is basically a sport bike will cost you $10,000. And you can buy a gyroplane today for around $30,000. So it's not something that's going to be a quantum leap more than that, but there will be some integration. And because you have two machines together, you want to reduce the weight. The reason cars don't fly, basically, is they're too heavy. Cars are cheap. You buy an SUV today, it costs you about the same per pound as cheese.
Yeah.
And I don't mean good cheese. I mean the bad stuff, the stuff Reagan gave away, right? So you get a 7,000-pound SUV, and alternately, if you buy a bicycle that people really care about, the efficiency of it, now you're in hundreds of dollars a pound.
Yeah.
So when you have an aircraft, effectively, by cutting the weight, you're increasing the cost. And it's not something that's outrageous. It's something manageable. And the design I have, it comes in around, well, the first one I flew was 435 pounds, zero fuel weight.
That's not bad.
Yeah, so it's very light, and it's nowhere near the ceilings of what people can carry around. So I think the machines will probably weigh about 600 pounds, and like I said, probably around 100 grand for something very efficient.
We saw during the TARP funds that the Tesla Motor Company got a lot of money from the government.
Yeah, good for him. Good for Elon.
Billions of dollars. What are the capital markets like for a project like this?
Well, to be simple, I wouldn't get into an airplane business today. I don't know if you're familiar with Cirrus. It's a very successful aircraft company. They were just sold to the Chinese. The engine company, Teledyne Continental, were just sold to the Chinese.
So Chinese are buying up everything.
They're buying it up. And they also have a lot of, I was just down at Embry-Riddle University in Florida. They have a lot of people there learning to be air traffic controllers for China. So they're opening up their general aviation market. So the bottom line is there's about 1,000 registered cars for every registered aircraft in America. So you've got 800 million registered vehicles in the world. That's 200,000 more people paying enormous amounts of money than you are people using Facebook for free, right? So, so the question is, what's the potential market for something like that? And I guess the answer is that I think cars that don't fly are making the ultimate compromise. And in the future, it's something that you'll want to have. And the amount of development money that's going into something that just makes people snicker, bottom line, is virtually nil. So I would say that the goal here for me is to replace very, very heavy cars that people sit in that, again, that are just evolving more into living rooms than they are.
More than one person be able to fly it?
I mean, the one I have right now is two seats. And that covers for most people. And in aviation design, the way you make airframes is you follow power plants. So if there's an engine that works, then you design a plane around it. So what I've done here is I've basically allowed people to make an aircraft that's based around off-the-shelf motorcycle engines, which it's not new. That's something Glenn Curtis did back in the early 1900s. But, you know, people are buying these, buying sport bikes that have almost 200 horsepower.
Yeah.
And they don't need them to get around town. But to fly, it's very, very nice to have. And they're ubiquitous.
Well, for a moment, I thought you were going to fly into the studio.
Oh, man,
motorcycle.
I skated in.
Stay with us. I want to talk about the scooter when we come back. Plus, we'll also take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, why does the government want to analyze your palm prints, handwriting, face, human irises, your voice? Find out next hour when we talk with Lauren Weinstein about all of that. And when we come back, we continue to talk about the flying motorcycle on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We'll take your phone calls in just a second here as we talk with Desiree Molnar, as we talk about his work, his projects, his flying motorcycle. You remember the movie Back to the Future?
Sure.
The little scooter that he was able to use to fly across, that big fly was able to fly across all over the place.
Yeah,
is that ever possible?
Well, you never want to say it's impossible, because then there's been too many people who have said that and been wrong. But is it possible today? Not that I'm aware of. But in the future, sure, back to it. And again, that's the flubber that we're all waiting for. And like I said, for me, it's hopefully that's an inevitable. But what the pond I'm swimming in is what can we do today? Well, let's not wait. Let's wait for the innovation.
Is it a big field, Des? Are there a lot of people, a lot of companies out there trying to perfect either the motorcycle that flies or the car that flies?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there are definitely some people that have been working on a long time. Paul Moeller's been doing this. Terrafugia is making a lot of progress in on the East Coast. And there's a gentleman I just met this weekend, Carvelli, here in Los Angeles area. So there's basically a group of individuals and small companies doing it. And I know that DARPA has just put up some money that I think Lockheed's a prime contractor for a flying, they want to do a Hummer, which is, obviously, the thing is, I'm going to go back really quickly. I knew a guy named, back up. There's a company that I worked for. A guy was a mentor of mine. He developed a lot of aircraft at Hiller Airspace. And Hiller did developments for the Navy. And a lot of these things, when they design them, it has a goal that isn't really relevant to you and I. For instance, you make an aircraft that has to go a long distance. You have to be able to shoot somebody or drop a 1,000-pound bomb on their head and then make it back and get away from the unfriendly natives. Well, the reality is that although the government may be funding things like this, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to trickle down to us, because it has a mission that's beyond flying somewhere close and meeting a friend and buying them a sandwich and then, refueling. So that's kind of what I'm looking at. I'm not looking for a military application. So obviously most research and development money goes into military applications as opposed to friendly stuff.
Are they way ahead of us right now?
No, actually, that's one of the reasons I started this. When I first started this, I was speaking to some friends, and I was actually very intimidated, because they said, "Oh no, we know some guys at NASA are doing some development." And this is back at Langley, and in 2003, and I thought, "Oh man, I'm just stupid," because I'd done this in the rocket world before. Like, you don't want to go up against NASA, and it's a bad idea. But the reality was that I think the way they defined their mission was making cheap airplanes and getting people to move farther away from town and fly longer distances to get in. I thought they were just completely on the wrong track, and that was actually one of the reasons I jumped in. I felt like, if you're on the wrong track, it doesn't matter how much you refine it. It's just the wrong way to go. And so, like I said, the reason I jumped in, I thought I kind of redefined how to approach it. And so threw my hat in the ring.
In 8 years in Los Angeles, just on Ventura, I've been rear-ended 3 times
already. Yeah.
People just smash into you.
Yeah.
What's it going to be like if people are flying all over the place?
Well, to your story, I've personally been hit 7 times, and not in the last few years, but in total. And so I don't commute. I just won't do it. I drive at night.
Yeah.
It's scary. But what happens in the air is, if you go out and look out right now, if you wouldn't let your dog run off the leash for 100 meters in this town because he'll get hit. Mm-hmm. But if you look up right now, Van Nuys Airport is the busiest general aviation airport in the world. You won't see anybody in the sky. It's the safest place to be. So there's plenty of equipment. We have ADS-B is going to be getting rolled out, which is a way to keep aircraft separated. GPS was actually the main technological advancement that made me go down this road, because now people actually know where they are all the time within meters. It used to be very difficult to fly and never know exactly where you were. You had to think about where you're headed, whether or not you had enough gas to get there, if you're going to find a runway. Today, you can basically fall asleep, wake up, and know precisely where you are, because computers will tell you. So there's plenty of ways to stay away from people. I just flew back from Vegas the other night, and we could see 100 miles, and we didn't see another set of headlights on the way. Yeah, I mean, that's how it is. You just look up. There's no one flying.
Let's take some calls here for you, Des. Let's go to Mike in Ithaca, New York, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Mike. You're on with us.
Hi, Des there. I have a question for you about if you lose power in the air and you're using your maple seed thing to come down. We call them maples over here, not sycamores.
Sorry, Mike. Okay.
In England, they call them sycamore, but here the thing we call a sycamore is uses a parachute. But this is so we call them maple seed, I guess, or a poly nose or pug nose or Pinocchio nose. But you're coming down like that. There's a thing that helicopter pilots do called flaring out. Are you familiar with
sure,
that?
Sure, they go into auto rotation. Because
yeah, but what you do, though, at the last minute, you reverse pitch. So it goes from windmill mode to fan mode, and you get vertical thrust in the last few minutes to make an easy landing. Does your machine do that?
It doesn't have to. What happens with helicopters is that they use the engine to spin the rotor blade. And they use that to basically power themselves up, and also they control their landings that way. With a gyroplane, you never run power from the engine to the rotor blade. You use a propeller, a fan, effectively, to push the vehicle forward. Imagine if your leaf is falling, your maple leaf is falling off, and you've got a fan underneath it. It'll just sit there and hover. It's basically the same way. You basically push this aircraft forward. The rotor blade spins, and it's always in auto rotation. So there's never a moment where things go wrong and you have to switch over. If the engine quits, it's almost like you're going to land. You just pull the power back, and you simply float in and land. And unlike a helicopter, it actually uses a lot of its energy on the engine. You start running it up when you come into land, which is kind of a dangerous position. With this one, it doesn't blow any wind down. The air's traveling through the blade. So you don't blow an animal away. You don't create a big dust storm. You just land quietly.
Does any need for a parachute on the bike?
No one's used them in the past. I know one guy has installed one. There has been a horrible safety record for some of these aircraft. They didn't have horizontal stabilizers. And so a lot of people have written them off on the safety side. There's a guy, Martin Holman, he has a website, Aircraft Designs. He writes very passionately about this. But I would say it couldn't hurt to use one, because the worst case scenario is if you go end over end, then that's time to have a parachute. But the reality is that it's designed, and if it's done correctly, it could be effectively the safest airplane you could possibly use. And again, that was why it was designed, a wing that couldn't stall.
Would you recommend that the driver have a parachute, the pilot?
Never hurts for anything. I don't know. Should you have a helmet when you've been rear-ended on Ventura Boulevard?
I
would say so, yeah.
Yeah. So what are the dangers, though? He jumps out, he parachutes down, the bike lands on you.
Yeah, well.
You know? That's possible.
It's possible. You're completely right. The bottom line is we want to fly safe. Hope. Nobody wants to get hurt. I've got all my fingers and toes attached, so I think I'll do more of the same.
Next up, we go to Bud in Los Angeles. First-time caller. Hey, Bud, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, guys. Very interesting show. I'm a pilot, and an old pilot. And back in the late 30s, there was a fellow, and I can't remember his name, but he developed a flying car.
Sure.
And the government wouldn't let him, I guess the government wouldn't let him do it. But he had the car that the wings folded back into the side of the car. And he envisioned that you would fly to near your destination, and they would be landing strips along the highway, and you'd land, and then you'd drive off. But are you going to be able to get this motorcycle legal? I mean, are they going to – in the late 30s, it was before the FAA, so – they just wouldn't allow, but I wonder if the FAA would allow that right now.
Yeah, but and like I said, your question is very, very similar to a lot of people's. First of all, the laws are getting tougher than they are since the 30s. And yes, a legal machine is a basic requirement. If it's not legal, we can't use it. I mean,
and it was Waldo Waterman was his name.
Waterman had a great machine. He took that across the country. And there was also in the 30s, there was a thing called a Pitcairn AC-35, which was also a gyroplane that you could drive on the street. And that one landed at the White House. And the first flying car actually was patented. I don't remember if it flew or not, but probably not, since it was before the Wright brothers did their powered flights. So yeah, it's been done a lot. And again, the one of the things about airplanes today, I fly a plane that was designed in the 70s, and it uses leaded gas. Okay. Uh-huh. And it hasn't changed at all. The engine hasn't changed. Nothing changed. You're not allowed to change. It's been certified back at the time it was developed, and it's not allowed to change. Well, on the street, the laws keep changing. It gets tougher and tougher to pass crash regulations, smog regulations, et cetera. So by design, the new vehicles have to actually meet more stringent requirements today than they did in the 30s. So although you can build a new Cessna Skymaster or whatever these things that were designed back then, you can't actually use these flying cars today. You couldn't go back and take the old designs and just say, let's just make them because they worked then. Well, actually don't work today.
Has anybody from government ever approached you to try to buy you out or to stop you from developing these?
Not at this stage. And I, like I said, I mean, again, it's a way to get out. If you want to wait around for somebody to come and help you when it's time to run away, then you can wait for government to come.
You don't seem like the type who would run away.
I also think it's very valuable to be able to rely on yourself. And that's one of the motivations for this was when things go wrong, you don't want to wait for the train.
How'd you get interested in all of this?
Well, I mean,
you seem like you know technology.
I've always been involved in aviation all my life and rocket development, things like that. And a few years ago, I was in Los Angeles and I wanted to get out of town. I'd just taken a trip and I thought I couldn't leave. I was trapped here. And I waited until about 3 o'clock in the morning and I headed east. And I thought, man, there's no problem getting around as long as you're driving at 3 a.m. You can drive on.
It's easy.
And so I realized, you know what? The real problem is it has nothing to do with the road system. It has to do with the timing. It has to do that everybody, I don't care if you're the CEO or the janitor, you have to be downtown at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and you're all stuck.
And so it's about taking people that are in a very diffused location and trying to get into a very concentrated one. So I thought, you know what? I want to start looking at this problem. And we had just done the X Prize, and people were starting to do rocket development, and I'd been involved in that a long time. And we always wanted people to get involved, and they started it. So I thought, you know what? Congratulations. This is great. Let them go. Let them run with it. And I started looking at this problem instead and just got obsessed with it.
Wildcard line, George is in Hesperia, California. Hey, George, go ahead.
Yeah, George, great show, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'd like to know if there's any way that I could volunteer to test these crap for this guy or help him with the technology. It sounds like a wonderful idea, and I'm more than interested in helping.
Well, if people want to get involved, what do they do, guys?
Well, they can contact me. I'm actually working with some students at USC right now. You can actually get college credits for developing these.
Really?
Well, they're very smart people.
Cool.
George Spenny is a very insightful people. And so, the bottom line is that...
Do you want to give out an email address? Or
yeah, just reach me at molnari.com. I think there's a link
there.
Yeah,
there's a link at Coast to Coast.
Yeah, and let me know what your specialties are, what your skills are, and be happy to discuss.
So, if you had a wish, when would you like to see these on the road?
Well, I've already...
Or in the air.
I've had one on the road. What I really wish to do, to be honest, and since we're on Coast to Coast, I'm going to throw this out.
All right.
I have a second machine I'm working on that's 3 times faster, basically, than the first one. It should be very robust.
And you're going into space?
I want to go Coast to Coast, George.
You do?
And I'd like you to cover it. I'd like other people
to
come out.
We'll do it like Radio Flyer. Remember we were talking about that? You'll call me from these various spots that you land and report on where you are.
I'll do it, but I want to throw another one
rather than get postcards.
I want to race.
Who are you going to race?
Anybody else who wants to come.
What are you going to race? There's only one of them.
No. There's other people out there. And I think what we need to do is...
Oh, you want to race to see who's the first to do it.
No, I want to race to get people to realize... That,
like an X Prize.
Yeah, but also just the motivation to show up. And the other thing is that, you know, there's no baloney left when the flag drops. So I think the thing I want to do is, first of all, and my background is somewhat in racing and rocket planes and rocket cars and things like that. It's very valuable for people to get going if they know that there's going to be some eyes on it. And you've got some eyes and you've got some visibility here. And I think that a coast-to-coast trip would show that people really have something that's robust and very real rather than something that's ethereal.
Oh, you would get the publicity on this one.
Well, it would help people. You know. It would really help drive development.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's go to Doug, Valley City, North Dakota, east of the Rockies. Hey, Doug, go ahead.
Hey, George.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
And I've been listening to your show for years and years.
Well, thank you.
It's the first time I've ever gotten through. No, I was in Rockford, Illinois, which was the precursor to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, 1968. And I watched a Benson gyrocopter.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow took off, and he got into pitch trouble.
Yeah.
And he started oscillating, and he crashed and died.
I'm sorry to hear it.
But anyway, I've always questioned these gyrocopters about their stability.
Right.
I fly myself in a Ronca Champ, okay? But these gyrocopters fascinate me.
Well, Doug, the Benson gyrocopter was a kit aircraft, very popular one. And Igor Benson, if you look at the history of it, these things were used by the Germans in U-boats. They towed them to use them as reconnaissance aircraft. And my understanding was that one of these landed in his office after the war, and he effectively sold plans for these, and people built their own. If you look at the design, it has a little bit of a guard between the propeller and the ground to keep rocks from hitting it. And you look beyond that, there's no horizontal stabilizer. There's nothing to keep it from going pitch. Imagine if you got in a 747 today and they took the tail off. Would you get on the plane? No. But the thing is that the gyroplanes were capable of flying without a horizontal stabilizer. But unfortunately, we're not capable enough to stop that guy from having his horrific crash. And so if you just retrofit it with that, or you design it actually a stable aircraft, then it becomes a safe plane. And you look back at the early Pitcairns, they all had horizontal stabilizers. This is something that they elected to omit, and unfortunately it was not a wise move.
You know, we had horrendous storms the last couple of days in Los Angeles. If you were flying, would you take up a single engine plane in that kind of weather?
No. One of the reasons that this has an advantage, a single engine plane, let's say, for instance, it flies at 60 miles an hour. You get a gust of another 20. That's a third of your airspeed.
Right.
It's substantial. These aircraft, the blades fly at 550 miles an hour.
All right.
You get another 20 mile an hour gust, it doesn't matter. It's just barely going to notice. Now you're a couple of percent. So it's better to withstand the gusts. But the bottom line is, no, you don't want to fly in bad weather. That's like abstinence. Everybody talks about it, but nobody does it. Sadly, people crash in bad weather all the time. I met Scott Crossfield a few years ago. This gentleman mentioned Oshkosh. I think what he's saying is they have an experimental aircraft show there. And I met him the same year he passed away. He's one of the greatest pilots who's ever lived, and sadly, he was taken out in weather. You don't want to fly in bad weather, and that's the whole reason for this, is if the weather gets bad, you land. You land and you have a lot of options, meaning you land immediately, you pack up your stuff, and you get away. And they don't send CNN out to say, hey, some guy crashes, he's landed his airplane in the middle of the 405, and now you're peeing in a cup for the next 6 months. The fact is that you just land, and you know you have options, you know you can get home. Unfortunately, people get into bad weather, and the first thing they think about is, how can I get there? How far can I get?
Right.
What can I get away? Yeah, you just want to be able to take that off the table. So you just land and find another way.
I keep thinking of the days when Richie Valens and Buddy Holly all died in that little plane crash.
Yeah.
They should never have gone.
Yeah. And the thing is, once you get, for instance, let's say you find yourself in a thunderstorm. That's a worst case scenario. Nobody flies in thunderstorms, but it can happen. And then again, it's not the kind of situation where you can say, I want to get to the nearest airport. You just want to get down.
Exactly. What kind of instruments would be on this kind of craft?
Well, the minimum required is just called VFR instruments. So basically, there's six instruments that are the minimum requirement, and it's altitude and airspeed, et cetera.
Okay.
And the other thing is, like I said, with GPS, I would say that, again, that's the core technology that made me say it's time to try, because then you really know who you are. And I would say for the average person, if they have the ability to know where they are, I would say that I would make that a minimum requirement. Not that it's legal, but it's just desirable.
Would they be allowed to fly into clouds?
You can fly into clouds if you have a rating for it.
Okay.
So that's an instrument rating.
Let's go next to Dan in California. First-time caller. Get you in real fast, Dan. Go ahead.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you. I was had the radio on, and kind of my spider sense went off with really weird, George. I had a dream about a flying motorcycle the other night. And no, I'm not kidding.
And
then,
now you're hearing one. We've never done a show about a flying motorcycle before.
Hey, I'll try and go quickly here. Was there a Molnari flying concept car a few years back? Are you related to that guy?
There's a Moeller.
Moeller.
Yeah. And when people ask me if I was working on it, because people get the word, Moeller. I said, no, it's that guy Moeller. I was hiding. So he's been working on it for quite some time. His design is a vertical takeoff machine that uses lots of rotary engines, and it's something he's been working on quite a long time. But to my knowledge, to date, he hasn't taken a trip from point A to point B that I'm aware of. He's done hover tests and things like that. My approach is different. I wanted something that used very little energy, very little power, and was able to fly. So, for instance, I think his machine's 800 horsepower. Mine was 50.
All right, Des, would you keep us abreast of what you're doing in your projects?
Yeah, absolutely.
Love to. Okay, great stuff. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.